The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to our special Space Show Classroom Sunday program. Great to be here. It's an absolutely gorgeous day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. So let me run through the announcements and then introduce our guest, and off we go. But first, a very special announcement, because I heard from one of our very, very good friend Space Show listeners, co-creator of the Space Show Classroom with Dr. Jurist, and myself, Dr. Jim Logan, and he resigned and retired from NASA JSC this week. He is on his way to Duke University. He has a special fellowship in hyperbaric medicine. We wish him well with his NASA retirement and his new career as a fellow over at Duke. I think it's about a year program. He'll probably be absent for the space show. As I understand, his fellowship is pretty intense, but we're looking forward to having him back on the road and on the air down the road after he finishes at Duke, and we will certainly miss him as being a NASA aerospace medicine doctor. But again, we wish Dr. Logan well in his new pursuits. For those of you who would like to call the classroom today, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Do let it ring and have some patience. We'll answer it as quickly as possible, bring you up on air as quickly as possible, and we'll hold you over a break as well. Given that this is a Space Show Classroom program, your comments, either by email or by the toll-free line, have got to be relevant to the discussion that we are having. Don't take us off into left field, because you'll probably be deleted. So again, stay relevant and stay on topic with us. And that number again, 1-866-687-7223. And you can email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we're trademarked, we're copyrighted. You can download our shows, share them, pass them around. Please, nothing commercial. No private YouTube channels, no edits of the programs, and certainly no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And do check out our newsletter, because on the website, our newsletter has the full bios and program descriptions for all of the week's programming, a future events section, and when we have to change our schedule, this is where you'll see it first. So you need to stay current and check that website newsletter from time to time. You can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter that goes out early Monday morning, just one or two lines about the week's programming. And if you want to receive that newsletter, send me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen off of our website, or you can easily and quickly download the shows. And we're rapidly approaching 1,800 programs and the 11th year anniversary of the Space Show. And again, we have a store on our website. You can't miss it. And above all, the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation.org, and we do need your support and your contributions. That's what allows us to do this kind of programming. And again, you do get a federal tax deduction if you're paying U.S. taxes, a California deduction if you pay California deductions. If you have any questions, let us hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then finally, remember, we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, please visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And that brings me to our program today. So we're going to be talking about the NASA bisphosphonate study. And we are most fortunate to have Dr. Adrian LeBlanc with us, and he is co-PI of this study, but he has served as the director of the Division of Space Life Sciences at the University Space Research Association from 2002 to 2010. He's a graduate of the University of Massachusetts, Iowa State, and the University of Kansas. He's been a professor in the Department of Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine and an adjunct in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at UTMB. He brings his experience with both ground-based and in-flight experiences to his research, and his interests relate to the investigation of the loss and recovery of bone and muscle tissue in weightlessness and the development of countermeasures. Also part of the study, Dr. Thomas Lang, and he is a professor in residence at the University of California, San Francisco Department of Radiology and UC Berkeley's Joint Bioengineering Graduate Group. And he received his BA in chemistry from the University of Chicago, a PhD in chemistry from Berkeley, and then after completing a postdoc fellowship with Professor Bruce Hasegawa in the UCSF Radiology Department, Dr. Lang worked as a nuclear medicine physicist at ADAC Labs in Milpitas, California. He joined the UCSF faculty of quantitative computed technology, as an assistant adjunct professor in 1994. As a faculty member at UCSF, his core interest is in the use of quantitative computed technology and other clinically available imaging modalities in the study of human musculoskeletal biology. And then Dr. Jurist is my co-host on the technical side. You all know who he is. You can read his bio again if you need to on the website. But we're happy to have him, and I'm really happy to have him helping with the technical and medical sides of this. Our toll-free line will be answered after we have had a chance to put our ideas out there and a little bit of what's happening. So those of you that are already calling us, it's not going to be answered. So give us 20, 25 minutes to at least get out there what it is we want to talk about. So welcome, gentlemen, to the program. Dr. LeBlanc, why don't you sort of start us off with the background of that led to this study and the basics so that we know how to move forward in our discussion.
Okay. I thought what I could do is give you a thumbnail sketch of the history of where bone measurements have been up to today. Basically, it goes back to the first comprehensive studies on the musculoskeletal system in spaceflight took place during Skylab, believe it or not, in around 1974. And there were three missions. Used a technique called single photon absorptiometry, SPA, and we can talk about the technique later. But basically, what they learned in there those studies is that there was significant bone loss, and also that it wasn't uniformly distributed. In other words, the bone wasn't lost in all regions in the same amount. And the next significant milestone occurred during NEAR, which went up about 1986 and lasted till the year 2000. And we conducted studies. We actually brought a DEXA machine. This is a newer technique that actually is still used all around the world, dual-on-off geometry. And about 1990, we put a machine over in Star City in Russia and began measuring the cosmonauts, and then later astronauts as well during the Shuttle Mir program, which lasted until 1998. What we learned from there is that we could now look at specific regions, and for example, the bone loss in the hip was considerably more than the whole body as a whole, and the hip, say, was around 1.5% loss per month. These are very large losses if you put in clinical tools. And they also had a rigorous exercise program going on, partly to try to prevent those losses. What we found is that in the ISS, the International Space Station, went up in effect around 1999, And we continue to do studies, and I'll just tell you about Tom's in our study using QCT indexes. But what we learned is that the losses that were occurring on ISS were essentially the same as on Mir. But with the QCT technique, which Tom can elaborate on, we could see that the compartmental losses were much greater. For example, in the trabecular bone loss in the hip, we're seeing losses on the order of a 2.3% versus an integral loss of about 1.5%. And it also allowed an opportunity to calculate bone strength. And these were even greater than the bone loss, the bone mass, somewhere around 2.5%. So that brings us to the current study. In all these previous missions, what we could see is that, and also in ground-based studies, the markers for resorption, bone resorption, was elevated, along with urinary calcium. That was kind of the hallmark that we see in all studies, including spaceflight. So what also is that we realized that the remodel, we call that process of remodeling, where you resorb bone and you put it back in, it's normally balanced. And in spaceflight, it becomes uncoupled, balanced. And so the result of that is very rapid loss of bone mass, loss in bone strength, and then urinary calcium, which, by the way, increases the risk for renal stones, which is another a facet of the risk picture that astronauts go through in space. So we reasoned in that if we gave a drug that prevented this increased resorption, we could mitigate the loss in bone. And so this led to this project. We did a bed rest study, an analog of spaceflight, and tested a drug, alendronate at that time, Fosamax now on the market. And it seemed to to work. And so it led to this current study where we've given the bisphosphonate once a week in space. And we've completed the treatment phase of this study where we've looked at 7 astronauts where we're making measurements before, during, and in flight. And our results are that we've preserved bone mass. We've prevented the compartmental losses in trabecular bone. We've maintained bone strength. The bone markers are normalized, so it looks like it's balanced. And the urinary calcium excretion has been decreased. So to date, it looks very promising. We're now collecting a series of astronauts. We're going through the same protocol, except that they're not taking the drug. And so with that, that's my kind of a thumbnail sketch of where we are.
Let me ask you real quick. Did you notice differences in age and gender, or are those factors irrelevant in your findings on bone loss and structural problems?
Yeah. Well, in this current study, we only had seven astronauts that we've treated, one of which was a female. We really can't see any difference and really don't expect any gender differences there in the effect of the bisphosphonate. In general, there's no real good evidence that women lose bone faster or more than the men. And in fact, they might less rapidly than the men, but there's really not enough data to make good decisions on that issue.
Does
that
age,
answer your question?
Yeah, does age play a role? The younger people do better?
That's a good question. The problem is nearly almost all the astronauts in a very narrow range. You know, they're from 35 to, say, 55. And so to try to generate an age relationship, that's very difficult. And any time we've done it, we don't see nothing pops up that would make us think that age is a factor. But if you were comparing 20-year-olds to 85-year-olds, then you might. but we don't fly astronauts in those age ranges.
Dr. Lang, can you tell us about the methodology that you've used to get to this point so far?
Yes. So as Adrian was alluding to in the previous, such as the Skylab study and the MIR study, particularly in the MIR study, there was a technique called DEXA that was being used. And DEXA is a very powerful technique and is used to this day in the clinical setting. And they were able to demonstrate in these MIR studies that there was sort of a regional variation in bone loss. So, for example, bone loss at the femoral neck and other regions of the proximal femur, you were looking at 1.5% per month of flight, somewhat smaller loss at the spine. But one of the limitations of DEXA is that it's unable to look three-dimensionally at bone. It's a two-dimensional technique that really just tells you the overall loss of bone mass. And what QCT offers is the ability to look at the bone loss three-dimensionally and look at it in terms of the cortical and trabecular compartments, which may change at vastly different rates. So, for example, by looking at an integral measure, you may be underestimating what's going on, for example, in the trabecular compartment. So, as a faculty member at UCSF, I had developed a three-dimensional analysis technique that used clinical CT scanners to basically carry out these three-dimensional analyses of hip bone. And in the late 1990s, Adrian and I began to collaborate, and our first collaboration was this study on the ISS. And so essentially what we're doing with this technique for this particular study is acquiring a three-dimensional image of the hip, and then we have a quantitative analysis methodology that can do similar measurements to those of DEXA, looking at the total bone density, the total bone mass, as well as breaking up these subregions such as the femoral neck and the trochanter into their cortical and trabecular components. And finally, another thing that we are able to add with it is an estimate of whole bone strength. So just because you see a change in either total bone density or a change in the various bone compartments, that doesn't necessarily tell you how bone strength changes. So there we had a collaboration with an investigator at University of California, Irvine, named Joyce Kiak, and she had developed a finite element modeling technique which allows you to model bone strength from CT scans in the same way that engineers model the strength of structures such as car parts and airplane wings and buildings from, you know, geometric models of structures. So one is able to construct a mechanical model of the hip from a CT scan and then subject that to simulated loads, such as the load applied to the hip in normal walking or the load applied in a simulated fall to the side. And that measurement takes into account, that estimate takes into account the whole three-dimensional structure of the hip. And when we applied that technique to our study of astronauts and cosmonauts on the ISS, we found that the rate of loss of bone strength was actually almost twice that of the rate of loss of total bone density and sort of comparable to what we found for trabecular bone density. So per month of space flight, we were looking at something like 2.5% per year loss, and that sort of corresponds to, you know, a 1.5% per year loss in a postmenopausal population. So people suffering from osteoporosis lose in a year what we found astronauts to be losing in a month. And then one subsequent study I'd like to point to is, as a part of this ISS study, we followed up astronauts after they had landed and then measured them a year later. So we were able to document the loss of bone in the space flight and then document what happened when they came back by comparing the post-flight measurement to a measurement 1 year later. And what we found was that with DEXA, whether we were looking at DEXA aerial bone mineral density or bone mass, there was a pretty good recovery. You know, 95% of the loss seemed to be recovered. But when we used the CT to look at that in detail, the QCT, what we found was that the volumetric bone density was not recovered, even though the mass was. And what's happening is that the bone is slightly changing its structure. It's getting somewhat bigger. It has thinner cortices, but it has a larger size to recover its function in when gravitational loading is resumed. And so even though the bone mass is largely recovered, it's a structure which is substantially different from the structure that these, the hip structure that our subjects had before they launched.
John?
A couple of things. One, I think it's important for the listeners to understand that if you're dealing with small numbers of subjects, it's very, very difficult to sort out the effects of varying age, gender, and the like, and that in populations of humans, large numbers of people involved in studies of bone loss, women do tend to lose bone mass more rapidly than do men. Secondly, I have a question for Adrian and then a question for Tom. The question for Adrian is, the recommendations for bisphosphonate use, oral bisphosphonate use, are that whoever takes it remain upright for an hour or so afterwards so that they don't get any stomach upsets and the like. And how do you deal with that in microgravity? And then the second, or is it even an issue? And then the second question for Tom is, using your finite element models connected to the quantitative CT, what kind of correlation do you actually get with measured breaking strength in cadavers or something like that? In other words, how do you validate the model against real bones and the situation? Do you have some kind of estimate for, say, the standard error of estimate of predicted versus actual bone strength?
Okay, would you like Adrian to answer your question to him first, and then I'll leap in after he's done?
Works for me.
Okay. Yeah, that was a question that came up very early on because the package insert requires that. But in space, you realize that there are no, if you lay down, you've got all kinds of pressure on your stomach and your abdomen pushing fluid up or into your esophagus. In space, and those forces aren't there. And you swallow,
right.
The main issue is, can they swallow the pill? And of course, they swallow things all the time. We're in space flight, and it's really a muscular
right.
action. And so that really was, is not a problem.
Okay. Tom?
Yes. So what I'd like to do is briefly describe a fairly large body of work done by Joyce Kiak that really was required to bring this finite element modeling approach to the point, you know, where we could use it in real study subjects and feel confident that these estimates meant something. And as you allude to, this work very much focused on validation of the technique using cadaveric bones. So essentially, the essence of finite element modeling is you're taking a CT scan and you're sort of getting two things from it. One of them is the bone geometry, so you can get the outer geometry of the bone, the outside of the cortex, from this volumetric, the stack of CT slices, as it were, and build up a three-dimensional model of kind of the boundaries of the bone. And then you have to basically, the grayscale values of the CT images have to mean something biomechanically. And so prior to developing this full model, Dr. Kiak did a lot of studies where she would take cores of trabecular and cortical bone, scan them with CT, find out their bone mineral density, and then relate that to real material properties such as the elastic modulus or stiffness, and then the ultimate strength of those samples. And so as a result of this work, she was able to come up with these equations that related the bone mineral density in a particular element as estimated by the CT to material properties such as elastic modulus and ultimate strength. And those became, or element strength, and those became material properties that are then incorporated into the finite element model. So once she had the ability to generate the bone geometry and then within each element to assign material properties, she did a very elegant study where she essentially took cadaveric hips from a series of donors and used one hip that was loaded in a simulated single-legged stance loading module where the shaft of the hip was potted in a type of material called PMMA, and then a load was applied to the femoral head, just like the load obtained when you go upstairs or you jump on one leg or you walk. The other hip was tested in a simulated fall to the side, and these were done on mechanical testing machines. Prior to that, she did CT scans of these hips and created the finite element model. After the CT scans, she then loaded these hips again with one hip of the pair loaded in a fall loading and the other hip of this pair loaded in a stance loading. And she had finite element models that predicted the load to failure in each loading condition. And she was able to show with R squareds of about, 0.9 to 0.94, a very high correlation of the predicted to the actual measured strength. And if I remember correctly, with her estimate for stance loading, the standard estimate of the error was on the order of 600 newtons or so, whereas sort of the average breaking strength was on the order of 10,000 newtons, 11,000 newtons.
Right.
Quite a good error. And there's a good correlation between the actual physically measured breaking strengths of hips and the predictions of strength based on Dr. Keack's model. Then as a further validation of this, Dr. Keack and I collaborated with investigators in Reykjavik, Iceland, where we were involved with a very large prospective fracture study called the Age Gene Environment Susceptibility Study. So Dr. Keack and I had an NIH grant to do these studies in this population where there were thousands of people CT scanned at baseline, and some number of them, on the order of 120 subjects, within 5 to 7 years had hip fractures. So what we were able to do is look at these baseline measurements, carry out these finite element models based on the CT scan, and we were able to show that low values of bone strength by these finite element models were associated with greatly increased risk of hip fracture. So there's sort of a dual level validation in that sense. I hope that answers the question.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
If I have a question from a listener, Jerry, who is in San Diego, California. And by the way, listeners, I have opened our line up. Again, please make your calls relevant to our discussion. Toll free 1-866-687-7223. Jerry says that you mentioned the frequency of taking one of these pills for your astronaut study. If we were actually doing a long-duration flight to a near-Earth object or to Mars that might be a three-year type of flight, would they be taking the bisphosphonate pill during the entire mission? Is there any information on how they would be dosed for a truly real-time, long-duration flight? So I guess, Adrian, that's probably for you.
Yeah, it's a good question. You have to realize that what we were really testing here was would an anti-resorptive drug, which when we began this many years ago, really Fosamax was really the only drug that had been out on the market for a long time. But there could be other anti-resorptive drugs that have since come along, zoledronic acid, which, and denosumab, that might prove to be beneficial. And the question is, would you need the drug during the entire space flight? And probably not, because it's really, I look at it as more of an adjunct to the exercise program that they do. And so it would be important, however, to know what's happening in the bone. And right now, there's no simple way of doing that in space. So I expect that that's going to change over the years before we start flying to Mars and to other really long-distance places. But I think this is just a simple one step in the process of how do we protect the skeleton during long-duration missions. Right now, the answer would be probably we would continue taking the drug during the whole time. We really don't. No one's ever done this experiment for that long. Our missions are all 6 months in duration in spaceflight, and it seems to work. But would it continue to be effective, and or would it even be needed? That we don't really know.
John, you wanted to say something more?
Yeah, this ties into some of the issues that we were discussing before the show started. And that is the association of pathological fractures with long-term use of bisphosphonates in the clinical environment, primarily in oncology, and then also the issue of osteonecrosis and the increasing fraction of the skeleton that ends up becoming basically avascular or devitalized with long-term bisphosphonate therapy. And I would really be interested in your take on that at this point.
Is that for me?
I think it would probably be Adrian, right, John?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you have a valid question. And, you know, if we're talking about a three-year mission, that's still not a long-term use of these drugs, as I understand it, that in when talking about a very small number of people, when you start talking about osteonecrosis that they've seen, that's been observed in patients taking large doses of bisphosphonate, more than 10 times the dose that we're talking about here, and for many months. Mainly, as you mentioned, in the oncology profession.
Right, and in that, the incidence of osteonecrosis actually seems to go up linearly with duration of treatment with bisphosphonates.
Well, that I don't know if that's true or not, but because there's been really very few cases that I'm aware of been published. There's about 400 cases in the world. And
yeah, I think that with the... you know, the avascular necrosis, that's really primarily a problem with the very high doses of treatment that are used in oncology. And it isn't,
right.
I don't think that there's a clear record or that it's clearly documented that you have an increased risk of avascular necrosis with the doses or duration of bisphosphonate used to treat osteoporosis in the, you know, the regular clinical setting.
Right.
The other issue is the onset of spontaneous fractures. So starting maybe 7 years ago, people started to report that individuals on bisphosphonate therapy for osteoporosis, where the duration of therapy was, you know, 5 years, something like that, seemed to show an increased risk of fractures in the subtrochanteric region of the hip. And that
right.
If you looked at x-rays of the hip, there were particular fracture patterns associated with long-term bisphosphonate usage. And there was variable evidence as to whether bisphosphonate usage could detectably increase the incidence of this type of fracture. But more recently, there have been studies where people have looked at health registries. Like, for example, there was a study looking at the British National Health Registry and a recent study done by the National Institute of Arthritis, Musculoskeletal, Skin Diseases, and there, you know, it's been been documented that there is an increased risk of these subtrochanteric fractures in the clinical population associated with long-term use of bisphosphonate, but, you know, one has to compare to the number of fractures that are prevented by the use of the bisphosphonate. So in terms of the increased risk, that's very, very small compared to the, you know, the impact of these drugs in preventing fractures. So I think, you know, I think we have to look at that carefully. You know, the jury is still out regarding a lot of the characteristics of these types of fractures and the risk factors, and people are just trying to understand, are just at the point of starting to understand this.
And it's always a question of cause and effect versus correlation. In other words, it's just like right. the osteoporosis of the jaw. Yeah, they go back retrospectively, and nearly all those individuals are on bisphosphonates. Well, they're on bisphosphonates for a reason. They have something wrong with their bone. And so, but it doesn't mean that it's causative, but there is some association there.
That's well, most of them have either prostatic cancer or breast cancer that's metastatic, or they're looking to prevent bone metastases, to prevent tumor-related pathological fractures.
Right. And they've also had chemotherapy and all sorts of things, which could be positive
activity. Well, you know, as far as jaw osteonecrosis, that almost has to be, at least in my mind, something related to some type of septic event. Although you can't make that case as easily for the subtrochanteric fractures. But I think the osteonecrosis in the jaw has to be somehow septically related, because there's also loss of the alveolar bone, and a lot of attention needs to be paid in these patients to you know, proper dental hygiene, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah, and then the astronauts obviously have excellent care and dental hygiene.
A question for I guess, Adrian, starting with you, and possibly for Tom, too. There's always talk that, you know, can humans do better if we have some kind of artificial gravity at some level? Would Martian gravity be enough, for example? I know these studies in space don't really exist, but can you extrapolate any data from what you're doing to get an idea of whether instead of microgravity you had Martian gravity or some other gravity level? Do you think that would make a difference on the astronaut bone loss issue and bone strength issues?
Yeah, that's a good question. And NASA is interested in examining this in ground-based analog studies. But my gut feeling is that it wouldn't. And I based it on the fact that from Skylab to Mir, the shuttle Mir to ISS, they have consistently increased the amount of exercise and the forces on the bone. And really, those interventions have not made a significant impact on the bone loss. So I would think one-third, what is the Martian gravity, like one-third G?
About one-third.
About one-third, yeah.
Yeah, so one-third G. I don't think that would be enough to have much effect, and you realize that most of the time they're going to be, otherwise they're going to be in a very small capsule on the ground or in space, not really exercising a great deal. But we don't really know. That's a simple answer is we don't know, and NASA is very interested in that, and they are planning on studies to look at that. Gut feeling is that it won't be very effective.
So just to add a little bit to Adrian just mentioned, NASA, through the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, is funding animal model studies to look at this issue. And what they've done is researchers at Texas A&M University. So this is Dr. Sue Bloomfield and Harry Hogan have been using a model developed originally, I guess, at MIT, where they do a partial of a type of suspension model, a rodent suspension model, particularly it's a mouse suspension model, where the mouse is partially suspended. It isn't just a tail limb suspension, which is one of the common simulation techniques used. It actually suspends the middle of the rodent's body in addition to the tail, and it can be used to simulate different degrees of unloading, such as the 1/6 G characteristic of the moon, the 1/3 gravity of Mars. And as far as I understand, the initial findings there is that partial gravity is not a particularly effective countermeasure to bone loss. So these this partial hind limb suspension or this partial suspension model of the mouse, actually the mice show a rate of bone loss which isn't that much different from what you see with full hind limb unloading. So the animal evidence seems to indicate that, you know, seems to agree with what Adrian just said, that partial gravity is not a particularly effective countermeasure to bone loss. Now, fully, you know, a full artificial gravity field is going to be a different story altogether.
John?
Yeah, they...
Go ahead, Adrian.
No, I was just saying, NASA was interested in artificial gravity, and the problem is that to have real artificial gravity in space, I guess, is a very complicated engineering task that for docking and undocking, you know, these procedures are very, very precise with where you move things inches at a time. And so NASA has not contemplated full capsule rotation, which is probably what you need. They did study, bed rest study, where they put them on a centrifuge, and they spun the subjects for a couple of hours a day. This had no effect on bone, and not too surprising to me. And they've sort of abandoned that approach. Now, the studies, they are thinking, the human studies, to use bed rest to simulate, say, a Mars gravity. What you do normally, they're either horizontal or 6 degrees down tilt in the bed. They can tilt the bed up somewhat, 10 degrees or something, to simulate a partial gravity environment, and those studies have not been done.
Dr. Juris?
I'd like to hear both of you reinforce what you've just gone over for many of our engineering friends who seem to think that there is no problem with bone loss in microgravity because you can just exercise and take care of it that way. And if it doesn't quite work, you need to just exercise more. And I think it's very helpful to reinforce what you've just been talking about. The other part of that is of interest is some recent studies showing some synergistic effects between high atomic weight ionized nuclei, which is a significant component of cosmic radiation, and some of the issues related to bone loss and tissue culture. And perhaps you could comment about how those studies may influence your thinking on the effects of microgravity on bone metabolism in general.
Tom, you want to talk about the radiation and the...
Sure. So, David and John, I'm sure you remember very well, you've had Ted Bateman as a guest on this show.
Yes.
And he and a number of other NASA and NSBRI-funded investigators are looking at this issue of the effect of heavy ion radiations on bone loss by essentially, these are, again, in rodent models, and they're exposing these animals to bombardment in heavy ion accelerators. And there, you know, these particular high high Z nuclei cause, you know, tremendous alterations, you know, tremendous loss of bone, alterations of bone structure, et cetera. And this is going to be, you know, an issue that people will have to deal with. And it's, bone is just one part of it, but, you know, certainly effects on the nervous system and cancer effects and things like that once people get out of Earth's protective magnetic field. And, you know, particularly exposure to solar events, et cetera. So this is going to be, you know, this is a major issue that NASA is dealing with. And the studies that we've had in vivo in astronauts have all been done in low Earth orbit. And we may conceivably, you know, see different results if we're able to one day look at pre-post-flight measurements of crews that are going on round trips to asteroids or to the moon, moons of Mars, for very long durations. One sort of interesting study that was done, and this is at a much higher radiation dose than you would see in spaceflight, and this was a study which I collaborated, but it was led by Ted Bateman at University of North Carolina and Joyce Kiak at UC Irvine. And they looked at various subjects who had had radiation therapy where individuals were exposed to electron and photon fields that impinged on the hip. And Ted at the ASBMR, or American Society of Bone and Mineral Research, as well as at some oncology meetings, has presented findings showing that women who, with, I guess, being treated for ovarian cancer, who underwent this sort of radiation therapy, had losses of hip bone density, and with finite element modeling, losses of hip bone strength that were actually quite a bit larger than what we saw in the astronauts. So this is going to be at a higher dose than I think individuals going into, you know, long-duration missions to asteroids, et cetera, would experience. But it's a hint of the powerful effect that radiation has on bone.
But real quickly, for one of you or either of you, do the medications deteriorate over time in space? Because we've always heard that prescription drugs may not even be effective given if they're going to be in space a long time. Is this a problem for bisphosphonates?
Adrian, I think we'll leave that one to you.
Oh, thanks. Tell you, I don't know. I know that alendronate, those drugs are fairly stable over fairly long periods of time. They have, I know Merck, I think they give them a shelf life of a year or something, but they would be very confident of a shelf life exceeding several years. Now, whether that would work in space where you have high-energy particles floating around out there, I really don't know. And I know that there are studies in the pharmacology area that are looking at that. In other words, you could put some there in, on a box outside the space station and leave it there for several years if you wanted to answer that question. But I don't have an answer for it. Right.
I think there's a speculative approach, and that is any of the drugs that are not basically powdered are probably more sensitive to radiation. So if you took your bisphosphonates and mixed them up to make an IV solution to administer as opposed to oral, one would speculate that that would be much more sensitive to radiation than would the lyophilized form of the drug.
Powder, yeah, or the tablet. I agree with that.
What happens in space if an astronaut cracks their hip or something? Has this ever happened while they're on a space mission? And I can imagine it would be pretty painful. I mean, how would you deal with that in space?
Well, it hasn't happened. I'm quite sure of that. Remember, the forces are much lower than in space. That's why they're up there floating around.
Uh-huh.
But that's a very good question, because we didn't get into the previous part of John's previous question was this idea of the engineers saying, well, we can just exercise more, and, you know, if we keep losing bone, we just exercise more. And that there's some validity to that statement, because if we assume that the reason that there's bone loss, it's the lack of mechanical forces on the bone because of the no forces in microgravity, then if you did exercise to replace all that, presumably the problem would go away. So understanding what that prescription is and how to apply it without causing the astronaut to be useless in space, you know, there is a different matter. Right now they're spending 2.5 hours a day exercising. That's really valuable time when you think about it. A mission might cost $1 billion or something. And so anything that could shorten that time or make it more reliable would be valuable. And that's, I think, the role that the bisphosphonates or an antiresorptive, let's put it that way, might play in the whole medical program to protect the skeleton. I think.
Yeah, and don't forget, add to that, you know, protection of bone is just one goal of the exercise program that is being applied on the that's being followed on the International Space Station or being anticipated for subsequent missions. Exercise is absolutely critical for preserving muscle strength and cardiovascular function. You know, there's increasing evidence that it's, you know, central to cognitive function and mental well-being. So exercise, there will always be an exercise program in spaceflight, but you may not have to exercise as intensely as you would to protect, you know, to fully protect against bone loss if you are assisted by something like a bisphosphonate. So, you know, there's a certain type and amount of exercise that's required to preserve, you know, cardiovascular and muscle function, and it goes to a whole other level when you have to generate the loads required to keep bone from being lost. And so, as Adrian points out, if you have a successful drug treatment, it may enable you to have a more effective and more efficient exercise program on space.
And don't forget also that for the 8 hours people on Earth are sleeping, they still have some mechanical loading on the skeleton that's related to gravity, although it's not nearly as much as you have with ambulation, obviously. And then also don't forget the potential synergistic effect of high Z radiation, especially for deep space missions, because you're getting away from the geometric shielding effect of the Earth as well as the Earth's magnetic field.
I think
that's an important issue, and, you know, it's of great interest to NASA, not just for bones.
What would the two of you have to say about the arguments that have been going back and forth about, hi-ho, off we go to Mars, as opposed to going back to the moon to learn how to live for long periods of time at some distance from the Earth in a basically a space environment? Do you have any strong feelings one way or the other as to which of those two approaches makes more sense?
I basically thought the original NASA program to go back to the moon and set up bases to learn to live in the long period made good sense. Simply put off showing it's not going to happen for 20 years or something, and then it'll probably be a single mission to show we can do it, and then it ends. And so I don't think it, to me, it doesn't look like NASA's on a road to sustain research and living in space. But that's not meant as a political statement. That's just, well, I think
the Gentlemen, I have a guest that is on the show frequently, Dr. William Rowe, and he says the only way we'll ever be able to do anything long-term or long-duration is eventually we'll have to do gene modification because of these issues. Have you thought about genetic modification? Is it even something that is seriously discussed? Is it out there as a potential, or is it just discounted at this stage?
Gene modification, I don't know what you mean by that, but if you mean selecting crew with a certain genetic disposition, is that what you're thinking?
No, he taught, and maybe Dr. Juris can help me out here because he knows Bill real well, but he's talking about looking at four genes and modifying them so that they would control these issues on bone loss and things differently than the way we are working here on Earth. Is that, John, am I saying it right?
About transgenic humans, like transgenic...
Yeah, basically, he's talking about transgenic humans, and I think that the technology on that is a long ways out at this point, although theoretically it's possible. I believe that what Bill's talking about is that in the long run, for living and in space, you know, with large numbers of people living in space, that genetic modification may be a way of dealing with this, because the pharmacological approaches and exercise approaches and so on are of relatively limited utility.
It's very futuristic and speculative at this point. I think right now people are just trying to understand what the role of genes are in terms of spaceflight-induced changes, not just to the musculoskeletal system, but to all physiologic systems. So I think we're just sort of at the beginning of understanding how genetics are involved in all of this.
Think about, there are animals that hibernate. Bears, for example, and their system has figured out how to preserve bone during that period of time. And as I understand it, their kidneys almost shut down, and they don't really produce urine during that time. So that's clearly being governed by genetics, and if we could figure that out, that might be interesting.
Yeah, the other interesting part of that, of course, is they don't end up with uremic poisoning from muscle breakdown and the like as well. I have a related question, probably a little more for Adrian, and that is, what do you see as the role of some of the differentiation pathways involving, for example, bone morphogenetic protein in affecting microgravity-related bone loss and the effects of bisphosphonates potentially on some of those pathways?
Well, that's pretty getting far afield from what I can knowledgeably talk about. I can't really answer that question.
I think maybe a good thing to talk about would be, what are some of the drugs that might be replacing bisphosphonates and might actually be ready to use when, you know, we start going to real long-duration missions way out of Earth's gravity? So, you know, there's a whole new generation of osteoporosis drugs coming out, and two of them, you know, one of them that has been introduced recently was introduced by Amgen, and this is a RANK ligand inhibitor. And so this is an anti-resorptive, like bisphosphonates are, but it interacts with pre-osteoclasts to keep them from differentiating into osteoclasts, or rather being osteoclasts from these multi-nucleated cells. And so that's one type of drug that's recently come out, and there has been a phase 3 study that has shown that this is effective in prevention of fracture in clinical populations. Merck is testing a drug which basically affects or reduces the ability of osteoclasts to produce a compound known as cathepsin K, which dissolves bone. And so that's right now they're in their phase three trials of this sort of new generation anti-resorptive. And then sort of coming down the pike, Amgen is working on an anabolic drug that affects the Wnt pathway, and this is going to be, rather than an anti-resorptive, it's an anabolic, and by an entirely different pathway, and this is a, you know, this is a bone-growing drug, so to speak. So there are drugs being developed now for the osteoporosis market that some of which have an anti-resorptive effect and some of which have an anabolic effect, but these might be the drugs that would actually be used, you know, years from now when we start undertaking these missions to asteroids, the moons of Mars, et cetera.
This was brought up before. All of those drugs are likely a liquid because they're IV or IM injections. And they would be more subject to breakdown by space radiation.
Yeah.
That would become a more important issue there.
Gentlemen, we're due for a break, but I want to ask you both a policy question that I think you probably put to rest fairly quickly if you choose to comment on it. Lots and lots of guests on the space show coming out of the science disciplines. I'm talking astronomy, physics, astrophysics, as well as the space enthusiast and the space business communities, distinguish between a NASA mission, for example, to Mars with government astronauts, and the private sector doing this with private vehicles, private sector people, and all of that. And they say, look, as long as we disclose the risk to the private astronaut or the private crew member, and if they want to do a one-way trip to Mars, or if they want to go to Mars, and as long as we properly disclose the risk, we're not bogged down by the constraints that government programs are going to have to dot every I and cross every T on human factors, research some of the issues that we've been talking about today. And the government should just let us go do that, just like they let us climb Mount Everest, for example. Do you have any thoughts on someday we might really have private capabilities to travel to Mars, and is disclosure enough? I've had people on that say all you have to do is spin the capsule, and any amount of gravity is better than no amount of gravity, so whatever it is, they'll be better when they get to Mars than if they didn't spin it at all, and that's good enough. This is going to be a policy issue, I guess, as the private sector evolves into a stronger segment of space exploration and space travel. Do y'all have any thoughts on this kind of approach? I hear it, honestly, and John hears it a lot because he participates in a lot of programs. This is pretty frequent. It's not that rarely expressed. Do either of you want to comment on it?
I don't think you're ever going to get space travel totally free of government regulation. I mean, it's just like the FAA will be involved in licensing the crew, and there'll be rules about who can safely go in these vehicles and survive. And I think that's important because if people go up there and start dying, that could kill the program pretty quick. So I don't foresee a time that the commercial would totally take over without any government guidance or regulation.
So you don't see it becoming like Mount Everest. If you want to climb it and you have the money, off you go.
I don't think so.
Well, I think that if you had an organization that was guiding people to Mount Everest, even if they disclose the risk to their customers, if they were negligent in the way they conducted their tours, they'd be subject to intervention by the government, I would think. And you know, you would think the same thing would apply here. You know, I can't see not having some kind of government standard to protect the people who were involved with this endeavor, even if, you know, one day private industry were able to do this.
John, I know you hear this all the time. You're part of many of the shows where this comes up. Do you have any thoughts on it or anything you want to add before we go to break?
Well, basically, I agree with both Adrian and Tom on that, and would also point out that in the United States, at least, we have a surplus of attorneys, and they're endlessly creative in applying 20/20 hindsight to situations where people end up being hurt or killed. And I think that would be a real inhibition for private companies. And don't forget that private companies are still subject to government regulation in the United States. It's not like a situation where you form a private company and you're therefore free of risk of regulatory intervention or litigation, certainly. So to me, it's largely a non-starter. And then you get into the issue of what does constitute a proper informed consent and a full disclosure of the risks of doing something, because people or their next of kin can always claim that they weren't adequately informed of the risks. So how do you do that and draw the line? You know, people in medicine have been dealing with those issues for surgical consents and the like for quite a few decades now. And the question is, where do you draw the line? How do you cut it off? And what is an adequate disclosure of the risk, particularly to somebody who may not be completely adept technically?
By the way, when you do these studies with astronauts, do you have to do any special informed consent disclosure, or is that taken care of just by the very nature of their being a NASA astronaut?
Adrian can tell you something about the informed consent process that he recently participated in for the study, but it's...
It's a very rigorous informed consent procedure. For example, for this study, we meet with the astronaut along with his flight surgeon, and I usually take about 20 minutes to go through the project, what measurements are going to be taken, what are the risks of every measurement, what are the risks from the bisphosphonate, and then there's a very extensive written consent form that they sign if they wish to sign up to be a research subject. So we do have a rigorous process for that.
Do you inform the family, or is it just the one astronaut and you rely on them to tell their family about it?
We don't discuss it with their family. That's up to the crew member and his flight surgeon. This is different than joining a mission to go out into space and fly on a very dangerous vehicle that might blow up. We describe these are all reasonably safe procedures that we're doing on the crew. We can't do anything that would endanger a mission, for example. That would just not be permitted. But anything like this, any research done on these astronauts are rigorously gone over, and they get informed consent, but we don't talk to the family.
Okay, gentlemen, go ahead, please.
How would they want us to?
Okay. We're going to take a short 3-minute break, and then we'll come back for the remaining part of our program that goes to the top of the hour. Again, the toll-free line for those of you who wish to call us, and don't wait until the last minute of the show like you usually do, 1-866-687-7223. And again, back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is the second segment of our classroom program. We're talking to Dr. Adrian LeBlanc, Dr. Thomas Lang, and Dr. John Jurist about the NASA bone loss studies and the use of bisphosphonates. And gentlemen, I know we have a little bit of an agenda here for this segment, but I do have Harriet in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a question. And Harriet says, there's lots of criticism over how we spend money in the federal government. And as we see, NASA's budget seems to be being decreased a little bit here and there in favor of different kinds of priority missions, the James Webb Telescope, the SLS, and other kinds of missions. Can you tell us the exact relevance to all of us who are paying for these studies through our tax dollars, but will never ever go into space? How does this affect us? How does it affect my kids? How does it affect me as I age? Are there tangible benefits coming out of this that we should all be welcoming and endorsing if we only knew about it?
Who do you want to go first, David?
Any of you can go first. Adrian, why don't you do it first?
Okay. Well, again, I can only speak for my small area in research into using a protecting bone in space. It's really, that's more of a health thing, to keep people that are going into space healthy and when they go and then when they come back. Now, how does that relate to people on Earth? It doesn't. Unless if people are going to go into space, which I think they will, it's our destiny to explore, go to these places, the new territory, but we have to do it safely. And so my small research is involved in one part of that area, is protecting the skeletal system.
Tom, do you have a thought on that question?
Yeah, I think that Adrian is being pretty modest about the importance of the work that he's doing. And I'd just like to say that the work that we do in trying to prevent bone loss in space not only affects astronauts, but the knowledge is of great interest to the study of age-related bone loss on Earth. And so, in particular, when we look at bone loss in space, not only the studies that we do in space, but the ground-based studies that we do to support the space studies, we are looking at the role of physical activity and mechanical loading on bone, and this has some import to studying age-related bone loss. So it may not be necessarily that because of this work we're going to get a new drug that directly impacts bone loss, but the knowledge, this becomes part of a whole reservoir of knowledge coming from all different areas that supports clinical research in the study of age-related bone loss and bone loss secondary to other diseases, and it supports the development of new interventions and all that, just not in an easily targeted way. But, you know, I truly believe that we do have an effect. And, for example, some of the work that my lab has been doing for National Space Biomedical Research Institute, you know, we were funded to develop a compact exercise device for use in long-duration spaceflight. And we think that there are elements of this device that will be directly useful, particularly for rehabilitation of certain patient populations on Earth. So one of the things that actually in our applications for NASA grants and National Space Biomedical Research Institute grants, and in our reporting, one thing that we really have to cover are what are the Earth-based benefits. So particularly in life sciences and medicine, Earth-based benefits, clinical translation, is a big part of our work.
I might add, one of the complications of in many diseases is disuse and the effect of disuse. And it's very difficult to study that population and know what component is causing bone loss. Is it the disuse? Is it the disease? Here we are studying healthy people, and we can determine precisely where this bone is lost, how rapidly it's lost, and the different compartments, and then also the recovery. And that part of what we're doing is, I think, useful for clinicians down the road as they try to unravel the different effects on bone.
John, any comments before I move us on to another topic?
I'd like to reinforce everything that's been said in the last couple of minutes and perhaps add a few more things, and that is historically the development of the technologies to evaluate microgravity-related bone loss was largely funded by NASA, and that has resulted in translation into the clinical environment with first single-photon absorptiometry, dual-photon absorptiometry, DEXA, and computed CT densitometry. And the more precisely that one can measure the strength of bone non-invasively, the better one can test the effectiveness of different drugs that can treat, for example, age-related osteoporosis. But not only that, by studying essentially healthy people in a completely different dimension or environmental situation than you have with everybody at 1G on the Earth, allows insights into the fundamental mechanisms for cell differentiation and specialization as it relates not only to bone growth and bone loss, but also other disease processes that are affected by many of these pathways that you're attempting to understand better. So Tom's point about this adding to the general fund of knowledge that benefits people clinically on Earth, I think, is right on point and cannot be emphasized enough. It is very, very important, and that work comes not only out of space-related research, but it also translates directly into things like managing cancer patients who are given bisphosphonates to counter some of the problems they have associated with bone metastases and the like. And the effects of radiation on bone has a lot of implications for people on Earth, not only with radiation therapy, but also simply because of background radiation exposures, medical radiation exposures. One of my pet themes is that CT scanning, although very helpful, if repeated frequently in populations, can lead to some additional problems in an epidemiological or population-wide sense. So all of this knowledge is of benefit, and every dime that is spent in space-related research or other biomedically related research that's relevant to space flight then comes back and has a potential benefit in adding to the general fund of medical knowledge that we all benefit from here on Earth.
And, yeah, I can give you some concrete examples of how work in that area that has been sponsored by NASA or NSBRI has led to concrete clinical translations. And one example that comes to mind, Ted Bateman's work on radiation and bone and the subsequent clinical study where, you know, we imaged patients undergoing radiation therapy with exposure to the hips before and after 6 weeks of treatment.
Right.
Maybe that will, you know, that will raise enough interest so that clinicians will have to try and understand how they have to manage the skeletal, if and how they have to manage the skeletal health of patients who are having radiation therapy. And that's over and above what's being done with bisphosphonates to prevent metastasis. And then another issue is, for example, Ann Kennedy at Penn, who is involved in radiation research for NSBRI, you know, as a result of her NSBRI-funded work, she's proposed of giving patients prior to CT scanning antioxidants. And this would be something that was would be done in a general population. And I think some of that originated from her work in relation to space research.
Well, you also have it simply with the medical instrumentation. You've talked about DEXA and some of the other techniques for measuring bone strength non-invasively or some correlate of bone strength. And I'm sure you're both aware, Lunar Laboratories, which is one of the big manufacturers of DEXA equipment over the years, started by Dick Mazes, and that directly came out of NASA-funded research to the University of Wisconsin on accurately measuring bone mass and bone densitometry. And that translated into the clinical environment relatively rapidly.
Yep.
What happens when you follow the astronauts when they come back and when they age? Are the effects of their having been in space still showing up? Do they stop as soon as you get back to Earth?
Well, so that's a very interesting problem, and the risks have not been defined yet, and that has been set out as an area of interest for NASA. And the question is, how do age-related changes interact with spaceflight-related changes? So, for example, a person who has experienced spaceflight-induced bone loss to their hip comes back with less trabecular bone, and what happens is that the rods and plates of this trabecular structure have been resorbed so that there's a limited template for bone to grow back. And so essentially, because of that, and also because of the peak bone stresses and strains that are applied to the cortex, bone regrowth after landing is concentrated in the cortex. So what you have is, with respect to age-related changes, the baseline is now a completely different bone than what it would have been before. So there's less trabecular bone and more cortical bone. What is going to be the impact of bone loss on that? And what is going to be the, you know, what is a person going to look like at 70 years old who has had the types of changes associated with bone loss and recovery from space? And what kind of disadvantage will they be to people who have not had those changes? So this is an area, whether individuals who go into space are at increased risk for more deleterious age-related bone loss, this is an important question that NASA is now starting to formulate plans to investigate.
So really the verdict is out on this, although I guess the educated suspicions are that this plays an effect as we age.
At least I think it does. And I don't think you'll find a lot of people who disagree.
Was there any of this studied when Senator Glenn flew back to space when he was in his 70s? Do we know anything from that?
Remember, that was just a week and a half mission.
Right, very short.
Very short mission. And we don't generally see bone changes in that short a period of time.
So what would the amount of time be to see bone changes? What kind of time are we talking about?
I think we're generally months, several months of spaceflight. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't things happening. In other words, especially, for example, in the bed rest analog studies, we see the urinary calcium go up very rapidly within the first week. It begins increasing, and that probably is also the case in spaceflight. The resorption markers begin to go up. You can see observable changes within a week or two. So there are changes going on, and the metabolism of the bone is changing quite rapidly. But our ability to measure it is limited by the precision of the techniques that we have, and they're quite precise, but they can't measure these very small changes. So it takes us at least several months to see it with DEXA or QCT.
And during the break, we mentioned the problem of calcium and excretion of calcium and the possibility of kidney stones. So can you comment on that as well?
Yeah, I think, it's not surprising if you have a rapid resorption of bone that you're going to release a lot of calcium, and where does that calcium go? It goes mainly in the urine. And high urinary calcium is a risk factor for renal stones, at least as a calcified renal stone. And so this is a side problem to the bone loss issue, but it's pretty important. There's been actually, so the question is, if you form a stone while you're in a deep space mission, or any mission, actually, it's a big problem. Let's say you're on a mission to Mars or to the moon, you're only a few days away. But if you're going to an asteroid or someplace out where you're a month away, there's no way you can come back. And if you develop a renal stone during that time, you've got a very serious problem. And you say, well, does it happen? There's actually been a renal stone reported in the Russian program of someone in space forming a stone. And it, fortunately, it resolved, it passed, without having to abort the mission. I've never had a renal stone, but I understand it's compared to giving birth in terms of pain and so forth. So this is a very serious problem. If you can prevent the bone resorption of bone, then you reduce that risk. And that's why we look at the urinary calcium in our study, and it shows that the elevated urinary calcium is blocked or prevented. And so that's a side benefit of anti-resorptive drugs.
Is there a treatment in space for a renal stone?
Not really. They've investigated, I think it's potassium citrate as something, but it's a drug you'd have to take every day, although I think it's a fairly benign drug that seems to help. It changes the pH of the urine, which is another risk factor. They can take, preventive-wise, they can try to take in more liquids. That reduces the risk. But all those are starting to talk about consumables and so forth. It's a fairly common problem. There's about 21 cases of renal stones in the astronaut corps over the years. None of them in space. Some are before flight. Most of them have been after flight. But we don't know if the flight has anything to do with it. But only that to say that they are fairly common. And hypercalciuria, which is high urinary calcium, is fairly common. And when they've measured it immediately after flight, it's a common finding. So that's a side issue that the anti-resorptives could help with.
Roger sent in an email from Denver, Colorado, and said if we actually had a human spaceflight policy which put us on a track with milestones to go to Mars within 15 years with humans, and it was actually funded, although I have no idea what the funding level would be, but let's assume it was adequately funded, do you believe sufficient answers to the kinds of issues you've been talking about today could be resolved to enable a safe human flight to Mars within 15 years, again, assuming the funding is there?
Are we speaking about just as far as Bone?
Yeah, I guess, since that's the main primary discussion we've been having today. So let's limit it to that.
I think there's more work to be done, but I do feel like we're on the right track. I think they're improving the exercise program that's constantly being developed, and I believe it's having an effect and improving the situation. I think the anti-resorptive drugs are another potential adjunctive type of therapy. They need ways to measure what's going on in the skeleton space, or some way of monitoring the skeletal, because one of the hallmarks that we see is there's great variability between individuals, and we don't exactly know why. It's likely some genetic factor. But I think all of those things will, I think 15 years, I think we could certainly, as far as home, be ready to go.
So 15 years, adequate funding, we might be there. Let me throw this one out at you then. What do you think what is your next step? And for people who are actively engaged in supporting and lobbying and writing their members of Congress, you know, for a quality space program, a good space program, if they're interested in getting answers and making sure we stay on track, what can people do that is supportive of the kind of research you've been talking about? Either of you?
Okay, well, you know, I think if... First of all, becoming better informed about it and following it. And, you know, one of the things that I think is very effective that the Experimental Biology Society does and the American Physical Society is getting their members to write to their congressional representatives. And, you know, this not only applies to spaceflight and the science that supports spaceflight, but just science in general. To actively interact with your congressional representatives and support these programs. And you may not believe it, but your Congress people actually do listen to you.
Yeah, I'm probably on the skeptical side of that, but I'll take your word for it.
I think that, you know, there wouldn't be the kind of active lobbying that I see from these, you know, the sorts of outreach that I see from the, you know, the various academic societies, you know, the outreach to us in terms of faculty, postdocs, other researchers, you know, giving us, you know, direction in terms of how to reach out to, how to reach out to Congress. I mean, I don't think they would be wasting so much time doing that if it were ineffective. And, you know, every time I've written my, you know, my representative or my senator, I've always gotten a response. Some of them have been canned responses, but some of them appear to have been personally written as well. So I think they are conscious of what reaches their office. And, you know, I think interacting with your representatives and senators and definitely going out and voting does help.
My two bits. What do you have for the next order of your research? Where do you go from here? What's planned for the next couple of years on these bone loss issues that we've been talking about?
I think, you know, my work in the bone loss area will largely be in collaboration with Adrian, so I'll let him take the lead on that for the bisphosphonate study.
Okay.
We're actually writing up the preliminary results that we have right now with the pre- and post-flight data, but we are collecting a control group of astronauts who will be following the same protocol using the new resistive exercise device that's up there, but not taking the drug. And so we have, I think, three have signed up, consented to participate at the moment. We've actually did an informed consent briefing with five others, and we're still waiting to hear from that. Presumably, several from those. So in the next couple of years, we'll be collecting that data. And that will be very interesting to look at the geometric changes that Tom has talked about, the compartmental changes that we've talked about, with the new exercise regimes that they're employing, to see what those what the effect of those are on those measurements without the drug. And so that's where my personal, for the next couple of years, that's what's going to occupy my time. And then after that, I'm going to turn it over to younger people.
So to those of us that are laymen in this field, we always hear blind study. So you're really not doing this as a blind study. So the astronauts know they're not getting the drug, or they knew they did get the drug, correct?
Correct.
Now, is there an advantage for doing it this way, or is it just because of the small number in the control groups?
The small number and the importance of informing them, what they want to know, whatever is happening to them in space might impact them. So it's very, very difficult to do double-blind studies and that sort of thing. Plus the small n. You really have very small ends, and to recruit them has to be done over several years, so it's very difficult to do standard double-blind kinds of studies in space with people, with humans. And that's the advantage of doing studies with cells and animals and that sort of thing. You can do more rigorous routine kinds of research studies.
Do you typically present your findings at a conference, and what type of conference would this be? Would it be an orthopedic conference, or would it be a space conference? Where would we typically find your presentations and your proceedings?
Well, we recently presented our up-to-date results at what's called the Human Research Program Workshop. Where all the funded life science research is presented at once a year at this workshop. So it was presented there. I'll be presenting these results at an international conference next month. And also there's an ISS meeting in Denver to look at different research projects being conducted on the ISS space station. I'll be presenting at that. And then at the ASBMR, the American Society of Bone Mineral Research, their annual meeting, my co-PI, Toshio Matsumoto, he'll be presenting results at that meeting as well. So there's the combination of aerospace meetings and also scientific meetings.
John, do you have any additional comments or questions that you'd like to ask or bring up?
I do, and that is, in the orthopedic community, the use of electromagnetic bone stimulators to help with delayed union healing and the like has gained a lot of interest over the past several decades. Now, there was some time ago some interest in using pulsed electromagnetic fields to retard bone loss from disuse in animals. Is any of that work continuing, and are there implications for using pulsed electromagnetic fields to retard bone loss related to microgravity?
At the present time, I think you're referring to studies that were done many years ago, and
right.
The results could never be replicated. And
okay.
So as far as the space program, I think they lost interest in going down that road. I think my feeling is it has not been proven to have any benefit. So that's basically where that stands at the moment. Now, for fracture healing or something like that, it may be different. I think it's used clinically, I think, to help stimulate the repair. But that's a totally different.
Right.
It's something that would be applied to a very localized area.
Right.
Right. Okay, thank you.
You have Randy is in Seattle, and he says, I understand that there are several brands of the bisphosphonates that are used. Of the drugs available today, are they all doing approximately the same thing? Or are they that similar? Or do any of them stand out? I know you mentioned Fosinex in your studies, but do any of them stand out and are different, or are they all now pretty much the same?
Well, they're not the same because they have different time, half-lives in the bone. They have different affinities for the bone. They have different ways of applying the material. For example, zoledronic acid is a material that's given IV, but then it lasts for a year. Osamax is the drug that we've used, and it was mainly for safety reasons that we ended up with Osamax, because it's been and used in over 10, 15 million people around the world. So it's really been well established in terms of what the risk profile might be. Whereas zoledronic acid has a shorter history. The new drug that Tom mentioned, it's over-the-counter. It's not over-the-counter, but its label is denosumab. The company has Amgen, I think, produces that. And it's also a liquid that's given IM. So, but they basically all work to prevent these drugs, all to prevent the functioning of the osteoclast, which is the cells that resorb bone. And I believe any one of them could be effective.
Carl in St. Louis said a little while ago you mentioned you had signed up 3 astronauts for one of the studies. I'm curious, is there resistance in the astronaut core to be used in these experiments? Why would you only be able to sign up 3? I would think that most astronauts would be willing to do this since the entire flight is likely experimental in the first place.
Yeah. That's a good question. Now, first of all, you realize there's only, 6 astronauts up there at any one time. Half of them are Russian.
Right.
So there's really a couple of Americans, and then there's Europeans and Japanese and so forth. So you're really only talking about 4 a year or so. And our experiment is not the only one. They can sign up for other experiments, and some are exclusive. In other words, if somebody else is doing an experiment on bone, you can't have both 2 studies trying to study the same thing at the same time. And so someone may want to do that particular experiment and not do ours. It is very little resistance to it. I mean, we've pitched it to now 8 crew, and we may get... You may get all 8. I just don't know yet. But that's the answer to that. It's just too early. We just presented that to the 5 about 2 weeks ago.
So you compete with other experiments that other researchers want to do in space with the astronauts. Now, do you only pitch it to the American crews And if there's a Japanese crew, or does it go to the Russians and everyone?
We don't. The only ones we don't pitch it to is the Russians. They have their own program. We have our partners, which are the Canadians, Europeans, the Japanese, and the Americans, and we present all of these experiments to all of those crew.
So, but the Russians have a separate program, so they don't consider our experiments and we don't consider their experiments. Is that kind of the protocol?
I think so, yeah. I may be wrong with that, but I have not seen any Russian cosmonauts that I've presented our experiment to. We used to do a lot more, actually. And I think they're trying to make great efforts to collaborate with them, and I know they collaborate on many, many levels, but the research program, it seems like they have their own program, and but I'm not an expert on that area. I just know that they are not asked to participate in any of the research that I've seen at NASA. So,
yeah, I mean, but if you look back at our space, at our original bone loss studies that we published in 2004-2006, almost half the subjects were Russians.
Exactly.
So they participated in that study.
Linda is in Marina Del Rey, California, and her question is, how does one sign up for or find out about participating in a bed rest study along the subjects you've been discussing today, or is that only for the Space Corps as well?
No, the bed rest studies do not involve the astronauts at all. And so these are all research subjects that volunteer and sign up for these studies. That's a good question as to how to find out about it. I think you could Google it and get to it pretty quickly. They're all conducted at the UTMB, University of Texas Medical Branch. That's a complex in Galveston, Texas. It includes a hospital and a medical school and so forth. And these studies are conducted in the GCRC, the General Clinical Research Center at UTMB. They have a very large GCRC there. And these studies last from... depending on what they're studying, but if it's bone and muscle, they last usually for several months.
Yes, and I have a link here. It's bedreststudy.jsc.nasa.gov, and that brings you to a page that describes that bed rest center that Adrian was just talking about.
So you're actually in bed for several months.
Yeah.
So how many days is a 60-day, 70-day study, Adrian?
It depends. The studies that we did at Baylor a number of years ago, they were 4 months.
Wow. Do they sedate you so you can make it through the period?
I mean it's not easy.
I wouldn't think it would be easy. Well, Linda, if you want to go do that, I'd love to interview you after you complete the study. I can't imagine being confined in a bed for 4 months for a study, but I guess we're fortunate that some people do it.
Yeah, no, it would be an interesting. After if she does sign up and you have to meet very strict requirements though. It's the testing is as rigid as it is to be an astronaut, basically. You know, in fact, they want what they recruit people to be similar to that population in terms of age and so forth, gender, and of course it is only two, male and female, but to get a mixture of the genders, and the ages are kind of limited, but you have degree of disease and all sorts of things. So they do a very extensive testing before being admitted to a research program.
So what happens when the bed rest study ends? Can you just get up and walk away, or is it kind of like sometimes coming back from space and you need to recover from it and you need help?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It is like coming back from space, and only not as bad. I mean, they spend a period of time after the bed rest phase where they're still in the clinic for several weeks. And they reambulate slowly so they don't damage anything or fall over. Within a few days, you're able to be back up and walking around in a limited amount. And there's a lot of testing that would be going on during that time anyway. So, you're under observation on all the major systems, vestibular, cardiovascular, bone, muscle, immune system. They're doing all that kind of testing during that period of time. Strength is another.
Well, you better have an active Netflix account if you're going to do that study. God, I'd go crazy. I'd be disqualified before I even got there to be interviewed. Gentlemen, we're pretty much at the end of our program, so how about closing comments or pearls of wisdom or what you think would be the best takeaways for our listeners today from our conversation and discussion? Adrian, we started with you when we started out, so Tom, why don't I start with you? What would be the takeaways or pearls of wisdom from your perspective?
Well, I think that this is the issue of bone loss in space is a very interesting issue that not only has ramifications for space flight, but for earthbound populations as well. And, you know, one of the key problems that we've had is finding ways to prevent this bone loss. And I think the take-home here is that, you know, we've made an important first step, you know, with this bisphosphonate study to get this problem under control. There's work left to be done, but, I think that there's been some progress, and I'm looking forward to sort of seeing the optimization of these sorts of drug treatments and exercise in the future to really, you know, use countermeasures in a time-effective way.
Adrian, do you have any takeaways and pearls of wisdom for us?
Well, I don't have any pearls, but I would just emphasize that the John mentioned the support NASA has given in the field, particularly in measurement of bone. When I first started in this field, there was no way to measure bone mass, and we actually, in the early days, were thinking neutron activation analysis. We built a device to do that, to try to measure bone. Well, that's a tremendously risky process. And they funded, first with single photon densitometry from Titan Skylab, and this then was supported by the University of Wisconsin, their research there, with Tom Dick Mason. And we actually got the fourth machine he built. And now there are thousands or tens of thousands of these machines all over the world. And so this was all developed. A lot of the interest was pushed by, because NASA needed a way to measure this bone changes in spaceflight. So there's been some benefits. This is very practical, this particular experiment. And I think it does seem to work. It does mean that other disused conditions, it can have more confidence in what to expect. And so as we move on. And that's about all I had.
John, takeaways from your perspective?
A lot of interesting work has been going on. A lot of it's relevant to health issues and management of those issues here on Earth. And a lot more work needs to be done. And one of the obvious solutions that comes to mind to the problems of small numbers is to get more people flying in space. End of my sermon.
That's a good point to end on. We do need more people flying in space. Gentlemen, I want to thank all of you very much for your time today and for sharing your wisdom and experience and knowledge with us. And we're very grateful. And I will let you know about comments that get posted on the blogs that may interest you, and I'll give you those URLs. And again, thank you very, very much for being with us today and for your research, and we'll look forward to continuing to follow it as it develops. And again, deep appreciation from the Space Show and our audience. And listeners, that's it for today. There is no program tomorrow. I'm headed to Los Angeles for the Responsive Space Conference. There will be an archive program Tuesday night recorded live at the conference. I'll try to get that up Tuesday night. Friday will be recordings of people I interview at the conference. And then hold on to your seat. Sunday, Inner Orbital is back with the Mill Irons and maybe their high-altitude skydiver from Germany, Olaf. We're trying to get him to join us on that show. Should be a lot of fun. But again, thanks to Dr. Lang, Dr. LeBlanc, and Dr. Juris for a fascinating and important space show discussion. Goodbye, all.